Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Jams and Tea podcast, where we spin the jams and spill the tea. And this week, we're coming at you with two brand new reviews for two brand new records. A little bit late in the year, later than we usually cover new stuff. But unlike years previous, we have two huge heavy hitters to cover this week, two essential albums that we had to talk about before we get into the thick of list season. We're going to be talking about the latest album from progressive music and pop music legend Peter Gabriel, coming at us with his huge album I.O. And of course, we're talking about the latest project from Kentucky's own Austin Lunn of Panopticon. We are going to be talking about the gargantuan latest entry into his discography, The Rhyme of Memory.
Absolutely. And I want to kick us off with Panopticon because this is an artist we've talked about before. We have a lot of history with Austin's music. We reviewed Austin's last album, and Again Into the Light, which was our 2021 album of the year as a podcast. And that wasn't just like a thing that happened. Like, we have a lot of love for Austin's music historically as well. Jake is a huge fan of the full Panopticon discography, and so I think it's absolutely should be you, Jake, who introduces us to who Panopticon is, for starters, in case anyone's not familiar with them, and giving an overview of where this new album sits in the discography and your thoughts on it as well, as a follow-up to And Again Into the Light.
Panopticon is a Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, black metal project that began in 2008, sort of dabbled in that wave of mid-2000s sort of new U.S. atmospheric black metal sound, and started off as a very standard incarnation of that, exceptionally performed kind of stuff, as Austin is an incredibly talented multi-instrumentalist. He's been putting out records ever since then and has basically been improving upon his formula ever since. Lots of split albums, split EPs that he's made, but I think that it's sort of commonly considered that it was 2012's album Kentucky where he sort of fully came into his own, where it combined black metal, Americana, with shades of things like bluegrass, as again, Austin is a native Kentuckian, and draws a lot from the culture of things like the mining community. And I wouldn't say that there are huge shades of post-rock or post-metal in Austin's earlier stuff, but that kind of wave of post-rock with a really sort of anarchic bent is something that's definitely shown up in his music. It wasn't until I feel like 2018 where Austin's music took a deliberately political bent. The folkier side on the album, The Scars of Man and The Once Nameless Wilderness, really brought a lot of that to the forefront. A lot of that other stuff is, you know, stuff that's a bit more textural details and on the periphery of the, you know, immense enormity of these black metal arrangements and these huge atmospheric washes that can often feel completely pummeling and completely overpowering. And ever since Kentucky, Austin has been on a run of records that puts him in the running for one of the most impressive acts in modern contemporary metal. And I suppose that after you make an album like And Again Into the Light, you still have a big set of expectations coming off of that. For those of you who don't know, I consider And Again Into the Light to be my favorite metal album of all time. I adore it. With each listen, I come back to that album and I love it more still. So naturally, expectations pretty high for this one, especially when you consider that The Rhyme of Memory is technically the second entry in a trilogy of records that started with And Again Into the Light. So I was eager to see how Austin's sound was going to evolve from the last record, just because it had been certainly going off a little bit more on the deep end, because And Again Into the Light was notable for having a production style that was suffocating, smothering, in fact. It was a point of contention, I guess, with that record, is that even though it was well received, a lot of people found themselves not being able to get on board with the extremity of the production. And The Scars of Man on the Once Nameless Wilderness had a similarly like pitch black sort of recording style, which is a stark departure from albums like Autumn Eternal, which has a bit more of a death metal influence. So with The Rhyme of Memory, I was wondering, how is Austin going to expand his oeuvre? Just because that's one of the most interesting things about his discography thus far is that not only is he making consistently incredible masterpiece tier records one after the other, at what point do you just start repeating ideas? And I wouldn't necessarily blame him for doing so. That said, what we get with on The Rhyme of Memory is not just another fantastic Panopticon album, but we get something that doesn't really feel like a previous incarnation of Austin's sound whatsoever. The amount of post-rock and post-metal influences on here is kind of staggering. It's something that he hasn't really done all that much before. And while you do get the traditional atmospheric black metal of Panopticon's typical sort of fare, you also get something that's very, very stark. I would say that this is an album that is as much about the harmonies, which is an element that has been showing through a little bit more on his records as that they've gone on. But And Again Into the Light is an album that I feel like that's more about the riffs, and it's about the fundamentals and how the production and kind of esotericism of that production style enhances those fundamentals. Whereas this is a little bit more ambitious. We see five colossal pieces of atmospheric black metal that are beautiful, structurally, absolutely audacious on a level that Austin hasn't been in years, frankly. And it is so captivating. And Again, Into the Light was an album that has a kind of redemptive arc to it. And the appeal is really hearing a man who is struggling to change and reckon with an inner personal conflict and attempt to sort of push through the production and kind of find the light and the humanity within it. Whereas this is an album that overridingly is a combination of two things. It is an album about mortality and struggling with aging and reckoning with death, as well as an album that is about Austin's anxieties about the current climate crisis, which I think is channeled beautifully into structurally what's happening here. But Austin's usage of classic Panopticon staples that are recontextualized within the meaning of this new record, particularly with the usage of things like spoken word passages, which have been in his music previously. Most notably, they appear in things like the self-titled or Kentucky, where he'll use segments of protests for mining regulations, or just sort of like pieces of news, or like basically whatever is relevant to the thematic material on the album. And what's curious here is that while the lyricism is broadly there, like you can like look it up, it's unlike And Again Into the Light, but the spoken word segments, on the other hand, are a bit more muffled by the actual production. This was something that at first I found slightly difficult to get on with, because the single for this released was See Your Skeletons. And off the bat, I just want to say, I think this is one of the most impressive things that Austin has ever laid to tape. This is one of the most dynamic pieces of music I think that he's ever made. And there are several, actually, pieces of spoken word that are within this track. And the first time that I heard it, I almost felt so overwhelmed by how many ideas are within it that I was just sort of like, whoa, I feel like you're throwing me a little bit for a loop here. I should probably judge this within the context of the record. And so I did, and I was able to get on board with it a little bit more then. But especially because this is a 16-minute long track, there is a lot going on here. And one of the things that I grew to appreciate the more I listened to is that the spoken word segments, I kind of really like that it's very difficult to make out what's being said during them, because I feel like that echoes the anxieties that are within this album. Speaking on things like climate change or aging makes it kind of emphasize the human futility of what's happening here, because the instrumentals here, more than anything, I think, are supposed to channel the primal fury of nature. And that's what a lot of them sound like. I mean, the overpowering heaviness of this is different than the overpowering heaviness of previous records. There's almost a kind of, I want to say it's a hollowness to a lot of the sounds here, but I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean that you can feel the empty space in this production very, very strongly, even though it is kind of traditionally suffocating. It's hollow in a way that makes you feel the entire body of these instruments, so that when they come together in a kind of harmonic convergence in points like on Cedar Skeletons or on this album standout highlight to me, Winter's Ghost, which is just, oh my fucking God, one of the most beautiful pieces of music I've heard this year. Like, the final minute of this song is just otherworldly. I mean, these are instruments that I've been hearing Austin use for upwards of a decade now, and they're making sounds that feel like I didn't even know were humanly possible. Like, it feels so ghostly. It feels so much like he is channeling something from a plane beyond, but still something that's distinctly rooted in nature and environmentalism, like all of his work always is. And frankly, I'm just kind of bewildered that he's able to utilize all of these things that have been elements of Panopticon albums past, sure, but use them in a way that feels, again, stark and bleak and hopeless and suffocating, but also an undercurrent of hope and beauty can be found in just the tiniest corners of this album, which makes reaching those moments and these post-rockier structures to these songs feel all the more rewarding when you keep coming back to them. I mean, this is just a stunning piece of work, frankly, but I'm a, you know, Panopticon fanboy. I know you're a little bit more, you're a newer fan than I, a newer convert to the church of Austin Lund. So I want to know what exactly you have to make of this album that is so different, but still so fundamentally baked into the DNA of this band.
The thing that strikes me the most about this, and you've alluded to it already, is that it is a really suffocatingly dark album. It might be the darkest Panopticon album I've heard. And what I mean by that is the most emotionally draining and hopeless Panopticon album I've heard. I believe there may well be glimmers of hope in this, maybe in some parts of the final track, which offer a little bit of relief with some of the clean harmonic vocals and some of the resolution that that offers, but so much of this experience is overwhelmingly, suffocatingly dour. What's interesting is how little folk and bluegrass actually appears on this album relative to other Panopticon albums. The essence of the bluegrass and folk tradition that Austin has incorporated into his records can still be found here and flows through in a lot of the more ornate instrumentation that's included on the album. But oftentimes that is buried beneath the walls of Austin's trademark heavy pitched black metal tremolo guitars. There is the extended sequence of the first half of Winter's Ghost, which is clean, basically, and it's a trick that Panopticon has pulled on multiple occasions before, where the album will start, even for an extended period of time, in this sort of clean space before you're eventually thrown into that oppressive, heavy sound after about 10 minutes of thinking that the record's going to be really, really pretty. Mm-hmm. Austin's done that on previous records before, and it's very effective. The artist I'm most reminded of while listening to this, and it's not like it's the first time I've thought of
is
this.
Is it Agalloch?
It is Agalloch, yes.
I was going to do it too!
So Austin's music has reminded me of Agalloch in the past, but it feels especially pronounced here because Agalloch mm-hmm. are basically the definitive band in terms of melding black metal and post-metal. Those are kind of, I know post-metal is a kind of a label I hate because it's kind of grown to be something so mellifluous and kind of meaningless that it's really hard to think of a specific sound when someone says it. Basically what most people mean when they say post-metal is basically just post-rock, except a lot heavier and noisier and often borrowing from the worlds of black metal or death metal or things like that, and just really slowing it down, melding post-rock with the kind of black journey stuff. So that's what I mean when I say that Agalloch are kind of the definitive sort of post-metal, black metal fusion band, because they kind of, their sound's so distinct and definitive and so influential that it's just, you can trace basically any band from the last sort of 15 years of this world of metal back to Agalloch. And of course, Agalloch are heavily indebted to Neurosis, and it goes back further than that. But specifically, the fusion of folk elements as well with that kind of metal style feels very true to Agalloch and records like The Mantle and Pale Folklore, for instance. That influence, I think, is felt more clearly here than it has been on previous Panopticon Records because of how adherent this album is to a post-rock structure, or a lot of these pieces are to a post-rock structure, I think. And one of the things that was so charming and so rewarding about And Again Into the Light was that it was kind of difficult to compare it to other things, and it kind of eschewed structural comparisons to a lot of the obvious reference points. It was a really unique album. The sound of it's really, really unique. The way that it's aggressive and edgy and uncomfortable is really, really unique. And it's just one of those experiences listening to that record that was like, I've never heard anything that sounds like this before. And it's really strange. And it took some adjustment, but it ended up being, and still is, one of my favorite metal records, certainly of the last 10 years. The Rhyme of Memory, by comparison, I think feels a little bit more accessible, feels a little bit less unusual, a little bit less innovative, I would say. And don't mistake that for a sneak diss or anything like that. I don't, with a record like And Again Into the Light, you're making music that's already kind of like so alienating in a lot of ways that it would make sense to step back from that a little bit and adopt some sort of aesthetics and some kind of edges to your sound that are a little bit more accessible. And in that respect, I would say that the Rhyme of Memory is probably a really good record to listen to if you've never heard Panopticon before. Another reason why I think that is that Austin has gone from strength to strength in his engineering, mixing, and production skill. The record is painstakingly mixed by Austin's regular collaborator, Spencer Morris, as well, who has, I would say, one of the biggest strengths of the album is how continually refined Spencer Morris's skill at realizing Austin's vision is. There's so much, even within the realm of this particular style of kind of dense, snow-blinded flurries of overwhelming layers of heavy music, there is more clarity, there is more space, there is more of a sense of dynamism than there ever has been before. And so that's a tribute to the, I'm sure, growing skill and experience of Spencer and of the creative partnership that these two men have as well. It's a tribute to how well they work together. That this, I think, is one of the best sounding Panopticon records to date, if not the best sounding Panopticon record to date. So yeah, it's an interesting record because it's suffocatingly dark in terms of composition. The fact that a lot of these pieces are some of the longest Austin's ever put on an album as well contributes to that kind of fatiguing weight as well. Yet at the same time, it feels more accessible. It feels more familiar because of how these songs adhere to a more familiar climactic structure. I think Cedar Skeletons, which you've already shouted out, is a stunning piece of work for that reason. The way in which Austin intertwines his thick, lacerating guitar with these kind of gorgeous violin playing is stunning, and the way that that become and the way that those two elements kind of start to sort of form a dance with each other in the final section of the track is really, really powerful.
The dueling fiddle and electric guitar on this is fucking like I don't care if 90% of these songs bore the shit out of you, they're worth sitting through to get to their final moments in which they feel as colossal as anything has ever felt.
I think that Winter's Ghost, by comparison, is a little bit more fatiguing. I'm not sure that it fully earns its runtime, and in a weird way I wish the first half and the second half were a little bit more balanced with each other, but it is still a really, really great piece of music with a really fiery, powerful ending. An Autumn Storm is a curious track, kind of bridging two of the most heavy sounding pieces on the record with something that is just so discordant and dissonant and uncomfortable. Just the notes that are held on the song, the tone of it, the atmosphere is just so wrong feeling. It's a really uncomfortable piece of music to listen to. I value that, while at the same time, it is one of those examples of where it feels like the record kind of can be too overbearing in the gloom and weight of it. And also, I would say, in the final few minutes of this song, there's a curious inclusion of a triangle into the mix, which I like the idea of, but in practice, it kind of just feels weirdly distracting, and doesn't really kind of fit together with the rest of the mix very well. It kind of stands out in a way that I don't like. So I'm not a huge fan of that track for a couple of different reasons. However, then you go into Enduring the Snow Drought. And there's something, I guess, with me and the penultimate tracks on Panopticon albums, because I was raving about The Embers at Dawn off of the last album, which is still my favorite Panopticon song. This is probably my second favorite Panopticon song. Enduring the Snow Drought is a staggeringly heavy piece of music. And it is the furthest the record leans into that spirit of post-rock, I would say. The most obvious reference point is Godspeed You Black Emperor, not just because of the song structures, but also, like you were saying, the preponderance of sort of doomy, melodramatic, apocalyptic political discord that comes through on parts of this record. But this song is colossal. The scale of it, like even just within the first half, I was utterly entranced by the dramatic tone to the riffs and the way that it was just kind of like booming its way through these massive passages of music. And then it kind of calms down a little bit and recedes in the midsection. And then it comes back for its final section with genuinely what feels like the most ungodly massive finale to any piece of music I've heard in a very long time. I had that thing where you just sort of start sweating, where your skin tingles. It's not just goosebumps. It's like you're actually like feeling your body flame up in response to this. A staggering piece of music. And then the album finishes with what I would say is almost its equal with The Blue Against the White, which again, as I kind of mentioned earlier, introduced some new elements, has some clean vocal harmonies which sound amazing, has the sense of finality to it. A magical record, not on the level of And Again Into the Light or my other favorite Panopticon album, Ordo Maternal, but all the better for it, really. It's a nice sidestep for Austin to kind of, I think, simplify his sound in some respects while continuing to hone his skill at collecting all of the instrumentation and presenting it in a way that feels consumable and allows you to kind of really take it all in. I think ultimately that's what this album is. It balances the fact that Austin is kind of working with more collaborators than he ever has before and infusing his pieces with a greater length because there are more elements, there are more digressions, there are more things that he wants these songs to do. And so as a result of that, he compromises on the complexity of the song structures and just lets them sit in a simpler space so that he can make all of this stuff work musically, basically. That's kind of what the record is. And yeah, I think it's a triumph. Slotted right into my top 20 albums of the year on first listen. Can only see my thoughts improving from here. Even the parts of it that I don't love, like An Autumn Storm, as I've mentioned, are products of Austin still reaching, right? Are products of Austin still pushing himself. One of the things I think that made And Again Into the Light one of the greatest albums of its year was absolutely that feeling of redemptive escape that comes through in the final sections of that record, the feeling of a weight being shed, of a light being embraced, as you said. And this record uses the structure and the structural influences of bands that do make music about that feeling, but it uses it to pursue something much less hopeful and much more dour. And so your mileage with it may vary for that reason, but still, I think it's absolutely worth experiencing. And I'm glad we had a chance to shout it out. I'm glad the record came out in time for us to put it in contention for our 2023 Albums of the Year list, because you can bet there's a strong chance it'll be up there.
And Again to the Light, Autumn Eternal, and Scars of Man are my three favorite Panopticon albums. Three 10 out of 10 Jake Corr records. And they're all so different. And I feel like he's probably pivoting to something that's a little bit more sonically accessible here because, I mean, yeah, think about it. The last two albums, you have the production extremity of And Again Into the Light and the challenging length and a little bit of the production extremity on Scars of Man. So him dialing back is probably a really smart move just because his last two albums were deliberately quite alienating. But what I love about him is that it's, again, it's basically what you said. He channels this sort of bleakness into other facets of his musical construction that find form and become as daring as the previous albums, but in different ways entirely. And there's lots of ornamentation that you talked about. There's lots of different details on here. He's working with lots of different collaborators, and it just feels like he's got a desire to expand his artistry, his sound, but also push the envelope emotionally. It definitely has less of an arc than And Again Into the Light, but at the same time I value just saying fuck it and then making an experience that's completely designed with a single-minded intent to just completely bowl you over, and I respect it immensely. I feel like it's pulled off with aplomb, and it's an album that just feels, every time I come back to it, it makes the limitations of the Panopticon project, a project that is so built on the combination of Americana, folk, bluegrass, and black metal, and makes this very specific combination feel utterly limitless. And that's what's so fucking exciting about it. So, man, you know, bring on that next album that we know is finished and we're probably going to get next year. I can't wait to hear what it's going to sound like. Austin has continued being one of the greatest voices in metal and in post-rock or whatever the fuck you want to call it. I really just couldn't be more pleased. The absolute, like, default, what I think of when I think of a great Panopticon album, this is an easy way to slot that in for that definition. Thrilled.
All right, let's move into our second review of the day, where we're going to be talking about the hotly awaited new album from Peter Gabriel, I.O. This is Peter Gabriel's first album of new material in 21 years. He's padded the time with the covers album, Scratch My Back, and the reworked old material album, New Blood as well. But this is the follow-up to 2002's Up. One of the things that's interesting about this, before you even sit down to listen to it, is the release strategy of this album, which is that Peter started rolling it out properly in January of this year with the release of the first single, Panopticon, and each month of the year, specifically on the full moon of each month, Peter has released another song from the album, such that by the time the album proper was released on the 1st of December, every song on the record had already been released. And I think on some level this speaks to, you know, Peter as an established musician who's been around the block many times, who doesn't really have any sense of the sanctity of withholding the music until the release date, who's obviously been slaving over this music for so long. And that is true. This album is not just like, oh, I'm making another album after 21 years. This has been in the works for over a decade. This album has been worked on for that long. So you can tell how obviously keen Peter was to get this music out there and to share it with the world, and how much he cares about, you know, the idea of the event rollout as well. I mean, Peter comes from obviously prog rock originally, and then a very successful pop solo career through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And so, you know, Peter is no stranger to pomp and circumstance. Peter is no stranger to even a little bit of pretension. It's one of the things that makes him so endearing and such an inspirational artistic figure, is how much he cares about not just making great music, but about making ceremonial music that feels like each album is an event. He's someone who really cares about releasing great records, I would say, you know, relative to a lot of the big pop names from the 80s and 90s, who, you know, often were, their success was based around the single, but Peter's always been an album's first artist. And that's one of the things I think makes him endearing to people of our generation discovering his music now, is because we often come at it with a mindset of the album as this, you know, sanctified thing, where great artists are measured by how many great albums they have, primarily. And so Peter is a really satisfying artist to get into because all of his albums proper are great. He's never released a lackluster studio album. And certainly never released, regardless of your opinion on it, he certainly never released one that doesn't have painstaking love and care put into the construction of it. And so the decision to release all of the songs individually in advance, month by month, is an interesting wrinkle. And also, the other major thing that will stand out about anyone who is interested in listening to this is the fact that you have on the main release proper two different versions of the album. And if you go on, I think it's some streaming services like Apple Music and Tidal, there's also a third mix that's available, specifically one that's mixed in Dolby Atmos for the Blu-ray release of the album. So you have three different mixes to choose from, although most people will probably only see the Bright Side and Dark Side mixes. It's a lot. Why is Peter Gabriel doing this? Why didn't Peter Gabriel just put the fucking album out, man? Why do we have to have these three different mixes? What's going on? Seen a lot of people reacting like that. Understandably so, right? It is a very, and someone who's less charitable could say that it reeks of a lack of creative discipline. Peter can't decide what mix of the album he likes the best, so he's just throwing them all out there and saying, you decide. Personally, and I could see myself adopting that if it were an artist I felt had less talent or past success or whatever. But it's absolutely something I'm willing to give Peter the benefit of the doubt for. And honestly, it's not even just that. I actually think it's really cool what he's done because it allows you to experience the album in, I think, quite distinct modes. I don't think that the mixes dramatically transform the quality of the album. If you don't like the album, a different mix isn't going to change that. But I do
No.
think that they offer distinct visions of how the album could be consumed, how the album could sound, what sort of album it could be. Because, like, so the Bright Side and the Dark Side mix. First of all, the Bright Side mix is by Spike Stent, and the Dark Side mix is by Chad Blake. They have very distinct personalities, I would say, especially if you are listening on headphones. And if you do, it's interesting because I'm like, this isn't a new, th this isn't a foreign thing to me because I was doing this very recently with Taylor Swift's re-release of 1989. I was
Yes.
like spending time poring over the original version and the new version just to get an appreciation for what the considerations were when re-recording this music in terms of how to make it sound. And that was obviously like with Taylor Swift, the whole thing was wanting to make it sound as similar as possible to the original because that was the point. But here with Peter Gabriel, these are two quite distinct mixes that I think have quite distinct characters. The Bright Side mix is much more pop friendly, I would say. It has more dynamics within it. It has more of a kind of popping percussion and sort of radiant sounds and this real sense of like radio friendliness in a lot of it. And the Dark Side mix, I think, is much more of a kind of how to put this properly, of like a kind of artistically fulsome version of the album, where it's like the Bright Side mix is designed to catch people's attention, I think, and to kind of be fit in, I think, with the way things are, sound now, the way a lot of modern music is produced. Whereas the Dark Side mix is much less produced for radio and much more produced to sound like a, I don't know, like a fucking Radiohead album, like a proper art pop album with a lot of balance and a lot of space. There's a much greater level of attention and weight given to the bass in the Dark Side mix, which kind of makes sense. Dark Side, Bright Side, and there's this whole kind of lunar thing that he's going for with the imagery behind the album, all that sort of thing. I have a lot of thoughts on the album itself, but I'm conscious of the fact that I've already spilled a lot. I don't want to take away from what you have to say, Jake. So coming at this as let's say less of a concerted Peter Gabriel fan than me, what's your take on the two main different versions of the album, Peter Gabriel as a musician at this point in the 70s, and your general thoughts on the record as a whole?
Well, first of all, I am big Peter Gabriel fan, for the record. And I've always had a respect for that sense of restraint that you've alluded to, just because I feel like a lot of people like him wouldn't necessarily put the reins on creatively quite as tightly as he did. I always feel like I am in good hands with a Peter Gabriel like record. And I mean, look no further than the fact that, like, the assembly of musicians, producers, players on this album is fucking enormous. I mean, like, You can tell that an album's roster is packed when Brian Eno's name is like snugly tucked into the very middle of it. Like it's a lot. And as such, the bright and dark side mixes aside, no matter what version of the album that you're listening to, sounds great. Like the actual quality of the production choices here sound full, they sound bright, they sound vibrant. If you're looking for a record that's going to recapture the magic of his prog pop earlier days, I think you'll more or less find that here. I don't really think that there's a moment where his age or the fact that this album has been creatively brewing for a long time, none of that really feels present. I mean, other than the fact that it's obviously something that was certainly like slaved over in a lot of technical aspects. I want to get the production thing out of the way just because it's the least interesting part of what all of this is and my reaction to it. I'm going to be totally real with you here. Bright side, dark side mixes, I barely notice a difference. I mean, and a lot of it too has to do with the fact that I didn't listen to this like immediately back to back, just because that would have totally ruined my experience with the listening of the album, where I would have been more eagerly and like earnestly, like I would be able to tell what the differences were, you know, again, like the Taylor Swift album that we recently reviewed. But the thing was, is that I wanted to have a more isolated experience with both mixes just so I could approach them as their own thing. And when it comes to how much affinity I have for these songs and the differences between the two, I don't really think any of these songs are drastically altered enough for me to have different feelings from one to the other. The distinct exception to that is probably my favorite song on the whole project, which is Four Kinds of Horses, where I do prefer the dark side mix just because there's a couple instrumental details that are in the buildup to that song that are not in the original version. And I prefer the dark side version just because I like those sort of textural details. Beyond that, gimmicks aside, which I'm sure you'll have like more to say, you've got a better ear for production than me, and it's something that, for as much as I wanted to like give myself over to Mr. Gabriel, he's a legend, deserves my respect, at the same time, it didn't really hold captive my thoughts on the record overridingly. What this is to me is an album that is overridingly about technology, and you should probably be noticing a few red flags about now. It's just like, oh boy, it's an old established prog artist making a very contemporary Perils of the Modern World album. This sounds like it could border on being fucking unbearable. And if you were, say, a more discerning when it comes to, I guess, the lyrical side of your music, you might find a lot of songs on here to be a bit challenging, frankly. And I understand that completely. There are moments on here where, for example, the opening 1-2 punch of Panopticon and The Court. Like, Panopticon and The Court, I feel like, are this album at its most sort of wary when it comes to its technological themes and when it comes to how Peter Gabriel sort of sees contextually himself within the context of the modern world. And in Panopticon, this approach I feel like works because it's a bit more lyrically succinct, and also the song just kind of fucking bangs. It's got a really great hook. It's just a really well-defined song. A lot of the songs on here are a little bit north of the equator when it comes to length, but I feel like Peter Gabriel's pop instincts basically shine through, where this is never a fatiguing listen, even though structurally it's like, wow, all of these songs are like 5 minutes plus. This feels like it might be able to, it might outweigh itself at some point. Never did for me. That said, though, there are moments like The Court where it definitely feels like, all right, this is a bit overbearing when it comes to the whole like, the frenzy, the technology. It's not necessarily that this theme is being tackled, it's the way it's being tackled. And here it feels a bit too glib to take seriously. But thing is, though, is that I only really find this to be a problem in the album's darker moments, which are mostly eclipsed by these first two songs, one of which I unabashedly love and the other one I just think is okay. But for the most part here, Peter Gabriel leans into what I think an artist like this should be leaning into, which is emotional sincerity, and specifically his own, distinctly, his own perspective on technology, on the internet and stuff. That's showcased very, very well on songs like Road to Joy or Olive Tree, for instance. And basically, like, when you hear Peter Gabriel sing, like, oh, there's so much stuff, which, again, very funny lyrical idea, but it's like he's sort of yielding to the fact that he's just like, I'm an older man, and this data, this all this kind of stuff, it's stuff to me. It's this thing I have to wade through and exist in, and it's this thing that has all these anxieties creeping in, and, you know, as you get older, it becomes more difficult to deal with, and you feel a certain distance from, like, the contemporary world. And that's what he mines very expertly on here, and he does it in a very big, bombastic, often very cheesy kind of way. But frankly, from the guy who brought us So, I wouldn't expect anything less from him. And that's why I end up coming out very, very favorably when it comes to what this album is about, how it's designed, how thoughtful it is. And it's just, it's peppered with all of the things that I come to Peter Gabriel for. And it does have a new, wizened perspective that I don't always think works. But overridingly, I feel like it would lose something if it had those, like, if it had less of the slightly cringier moments, because it paints less of a complete portrait, I guess. It's what separates an album like Io from an album like The Future Bites, where one album is distinctly more rooted in the idea of existing within the context of all of these things. And frankly, with the rise of things like AI and just how overwhelming the internet has been to me personally lately, I don't know. There is something here that I deeply connected with when it comes to the overstimulation of information and the absolute paralyzing fear that that can cause in you, but also the ubiquitousness of connection that's still, you know, gotten Peter Gabriel this far. And there is sort of some musings on mortality and aging that do feel very resonant. And what can I say? I have a soft spot for it, but I don't think that this is, like, my evaluation of this album doesn't come from me being like, oh, that Peter Gabriel, he's so charming, and how he's kind of clumsily navigating this topic. I think it's an expertly put together record, and it just is slightly hampered by the fact that there's so much going on. There's so much going on in these songs. There's so many musicians. They're so long. There's a lot to digest when it comes to the mixes, when it comes to what it's about. It's a bit, ironically, overstimulating to even consume. But if you pick the version of the album that you prefer and you sit down and you listen to that version, you're going to walk away, at least I think, with a solid experience that'll give you exactly more or less what you're looking for.
I think a better point of contrast than Future Bites is the last thing we talked about with that featured Peter Gabriel, Arcade Fire's Wii.
And forgive me for forgetting that Peter Gabriel was on that album.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because you would be fair to feel weary of this, if, you know, given that that was Peter Gabriel's last sort of thing that he was majorly involved in. But I bring it up because what makes this album charming, in spite of and sometimes because of its sometimes clunky lyrical approaches to, you know, a topic that's as well trodden as, you know, A Girl Broke My Heart, basically, this point in music, which is that, you know, the overstimulation of technology and the fast pace of the modern world. The difference is Arcade Fire's Wii is a fundamentally cynical album that comes from a place of cheapness as well. It's like it's banking on that cynicism to win easy points, basically. It feels heartless and moronic and stupid. And my rage at that album has not wavered a single bit. In fact, I'm going to step myself back from it now so I don't go back there. But Io, Peter Gabriel's new album, is a fundamentally optimistic record. Peter does talk about, overstimulation and the role that technology plays in our lives. And yes, he uses his turns of phrase that are very old man. I mean, panopticon.
Inelegant.
Panopticon. Get it? Because it's like we live in a panopticon, but it's the internet.
Oh my God, I just noticed that we're reviewing Panopticon twice. Holy shit.
So yeah, and then there's parts of it as well where he says mobile phone instead of just phone. He talks a lot about data, and it's very much the kind of stuff that you feel like he would have written maybe 10, 15 years ago, and just sort of
Yeah,
sounds a little bit
definitely.
anachronistic now. But it is like it's a genuinely optimistic record that, and again, in contrast to something like Arcade Fire, the record's emotional bent doesn't feel cheap. Because so much of it
No.
is deepened by Peter Gabriel's life experience and by the comfort that the album offers, I think, genuinely. It's got a sense of humor, I think, and it's cheesiness at certain elements as well. There are parts of the record like Playing for Time, which has this kind of grand,
Yeah.
swelling orchestral arrangement that feels very Randy Newman to me, honestly. Like
Yeah.
it's a little bit much, and it kind of builds and builds and
It's
builds.
kind of singer-songwriter, like almost Elton John-esque.
Yeah. And it's like I'm listening to this and I'm like, this is really laying it on thick, Peter, but it's also like I love this. I love it. Because of how fully it embraces the cheesiness of it.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the thing also is that some of the elements of this record are cheesy and well trodden, and there's some cliches and some clunkers in the lyrics. But there's something to be said for how forgivable that all is when it's being delivered with the authority and force and power of a vocalist like Peter Gabriel as well. He is one of the most important singers in my life. I've grown up hearing his voice from a very young age. He's my dad's favorite artist in general. I know his
Based.
voice as well as I know your voice, Jake, if not better.
Hello.
I have. Like Peter Gabriel like raised me to a certain extent, just hearing that voice
I feel you.
in those early Genesis records and in his solo work as well. So hearing him now, in his 70s, he's born in 1950, I think. So he's like 73. Like hearing him now, like new music that crucially sounds new as well. And this is the other thing about the way this record is slaved over and how much clear care and time is put into this record is that despite the fact this thing's been in the oven for a long time, it doesn't feel anachronistic musically or in terms of production,
No.
regardless of which mix you're listening to. It feels very modern, it feels very slick, it feels very exciting to listen to. A song like I.O., the title track on the record, really imbues that. I think I love the radiant chords in this track, the way that Peter's voice soars. Four Kinds of Horses, which I probably agree is the best song on the record as well, has this beautiful swell to it. In fact, the first half of this record is
Oh, yeah.
basically knocks it out of the park. I quite like the chord, to be honest. I especially love the very Trent Reznor-esque piano that comes in to the final part of this
Yeah,
song. And it
yeah.
reminds me so much of the way that Reznor composes piano lines, but also the way that he makes them sound. So I really, really enjoyed that. Road to Joy has this great kind of funky swagger to it. Both versions of this sound great. I think the record has somewhat of a front-loading problem because there's a lot of slower-paced mid-tempo songs in the back half, maybe one or two too many. And that's really the only thing that holds me back from calling this an out and out just fantastic album. I think this is a great record, very, very close to being sort of in my top 25, 30 of the year. But it is a record that has a bit of a pacing problem. And I don't think it's that it's poorly sequenced. I just think that there's one or two too many songs on it. Like
Yeah.
I could do without So Much and I could do without And Still. They both kind of feel a little bit redundant with each other because they are so lengthy and so sort of really skeletal, especially on a record where the best parts and the things that are most exciting are how well balanced and vibrant the more massive pieces of music feel. That said, Peter is still a great Peter Steele has a great skill for balladry. I think that Love Can Heal, despite the very cheesy refrain, and Sentiment is one of the stronger quiet tracks on this record. Just has a really beautiful sound to it. This Is Home is an interesting song as well. I think this is a great example of if you want to really get a strong sense for how the two mixes of this record are different, I would say just listen to the first few seconds of This Is Home Bright Side and This Is Home Dark Side. They sound radically different. Like, This Is Home Bright Side really feels like kind of pop radio tuned and like for the worse, I think, whereas This Is Home Dark Side has so much more weight and balance to it. And that's just a kind of one thing I would point to for an example of that. I think the record ends really strongly as well. I love Live and Let Live, as I think is a fantastic finale.
Yeah.
I get chills, even though it's, you know, leaning, even though it's very kind of a bit kind of rote and a bit kind of, you know, obvious what he's doing. Peter sells it so well. And yeah, and the record really is just a treasure to listen to. I mean, you brought up Stephen Wilson in terms of a comparison on the technological theme, but I mean the experience of listening to this to me and just basking in the richness of the sound was not unlike the time I spent with Stephen's album from this year, The Harmony Codex, which is obviously a very different record and what it's going for, but you know, both records are similarly the product of intense amounts of labor and craft in terms of the art of this sort of soundscape. And the way that Peter applies that to his great songwriting skill and his, you know, ability to churn out great hooks and memorable melodies is just one of the things that makes this record a cut above, I would say. It's also interesting as well because the last Peter Gabriel album, Up, was pretty handily, I would say, one of the darker Peter Gabriel albums, a really kind of moody record that is in a kind of exists in a sort of miasma headspace. I think it's a great album, has some Peter's best songs on it, but it's a tough listen at times. So weirdly enough, even though there's 21 years between them, IO feels almost like a response to that album. It feels so much more vibrant and lively. I would say it is the most vibrant and lively Peter Gabriel album since So. And it's a real treasure. I know that you enjoyed it more than you expected you would. But I certainly enjoyed it more than I expected I would as well. It was just a really just... It's been really, really nice listening to it. And then listening to all the different mixes has not felt like homework at all. I only really dipped into the inside mix, which is the Dolby Atmos version. But I would definitely recommend that if you enjoy the album, because it's just hearing these mixes, which already sound great, but hearing the songs kind of deliberately engineered for a kind of surround 3D space thing, because it's supposed to be the inside mix is going on the Blu-ray release of the album, so it's supposed to be heard on like a massive stereo and speakers and stuff, but even on headphones that mix sounds completely different too and sounds wide and rich and sort of widescreen. So it's been really cool enjoying this album for what it is, but also enjoying the novelty that its release pattern has offered in terms of thinking about, you know, how these songs can exist in different forms and the process as well of composing. I think Peter is deliberately inviting you to kind of think about that and think about the fact that songs, you know, there's a huge difference between when a song is written and when a song is finished. And things as subtle as, you know, the personality of the person who's mixing it can dramatically alter the feel of the music. What I'll also mention as much as a cool detail is that the two different mixes of the record were done without awareness of the other mix. So Spike Stent mixed it not knowing that someone else was also doing their own mix and not hearing the own mix. So the two mixes exist in complete sort of isolation from each other, not influenced by one another, which I think is cool. It's like Peter Gabriel, one of the greatest songwriters of, you know, the last several generations, offering up his work to these different visionaries and saying, interpret this. And I like that. I love that. I love the way that the release pattern then involves the listener in that interpretation process as well. I just think it's super, super cool. Really into it. Yeah, it's fucking awesome. And I highly recommend it. It might seem daunting to look this up on streaming services and see, especially because of the way it's been released, such that the two mixes are on the one release. It might look a little bit sort of daunting, and you might think like, oh, do I have to, does that mean I have to listen to both mixes to, you know, decide my opinion? You don't, though I would encourage it. I would say if you are listening in the car, or if you're listening in AirPods, or if you're listening kind of on the go, the Bright Side mix, I think it's better attuned to how people consume music. generally nowadays. Whereas if you're the kind of person who likes to kind of sit inside with proper cans on and really take in a soundscape, then the dark side mix would be the one I'd go for, or the inside mix, if you've got access to that as well. So it just depends on, and if you enjoy the album enough in the mix you choose to listen to it, then go and listen to the other one and see, if your feelings change. It's really cool. I hope also that it gets people interested in mixing and engineering as a process as well, because it's something that's kind of ignored and discarded, and sometimes things like mixing and mastering and production are all kind of conflated into this one amorphous blob. Sometimes people, when they talk about the sound of the album, they conflate that with mixing, like when they talk about genre influences and stuff. So I think there's a real lack of understanding of what engineering and mixing is in music. And so another reason why I value this is that it kind of gets you to sort of think about it actively, because Peter puts it in your face. And that's something I think we could all benefit from thinking about and educating ourselves on more, because it only deepens and enriches your appreciation for music, I would say. So yeah, great album. Let us know what you think of either of the albums we've discussed today, Panopticon's The Rime of Memory or Peter Gabriel's I.O. Want to hear your thoughts, want to hear your takes in the comments below. Do you have particular interpretations of these albums? Is there a version of Peter's album you prefer? Any additional comments, any thoughts you have, let us know in the comments below so we can continue the conversation. If you want to support us directly, become a member of the Jams and Tea family, you can hit the join button for just $1 a month, get your name in the title crawl of every video on this channel. Plus, if you recommend us some music to listen to, your recommendation will go to the top of the pile. Until next time, though, folks, rock over London, rock on Chicago, Lays, bet you can't eat just one.